Welcome back to the True Crime Fan Club Podcast. I'm your host, Lainey.
You are a con man, a convicted paedophile and a bigamist. You are an inveterate exploiter of vulnerable women, not just financially, but also emotionally.
Judge Thomas Corey said this to William Jordan as he handed down his sentence. One of his ex-wives has decided to speak out and share her experience. This is Mary's story. Okay. On to the show.
I'm a Scottish girl from Edinburgh, Scotland, UK. And I grew up in Edinburgh, went to school here, and got reasonable qualifications. I've got a couple of degrees. Marketing specialist, working with small businesses and helping people expand and grow their businesses. When I met a chap in the year 2000, when I was just 35 years old.
I was introduced to Mary by Tyler from the Minds of Madness. She gave me a brief overview of the story she wanted to tell, and I couldn't resist. This story has to be shared. Mary is a very strong woman. And I'll be honest, I had some preconceived notions that she was going to be some fool claiming she fell for love because she was desperately lonely and insecure. That is until I spoke with her, and I realized then that what happened to Mary can happen to anyone.
I had a one-year-old daughter because the father was a musician. Classic reason why she'd never get involved in with a musician. The relationship hadn't worked out. So he'd left when she was 9 months old. So I'd sort of been on my own for a few months. And one of my friends said to me, why don't you try internet dating? This newfangled thing in the year 2000, this is the new way to meet people. And being a single mom and full-time working and everything else, I thought, well, I'll give it a shot. What could go wrong? I sort of took a long time to actually think about what I would say on a profile. I can't remember the exact matching dating site that I was using. Well, it doesn't exist now, that's for sure. I took a long time, you know, saying, well, I like dancing and I like these books and I like, you know, these are the things I like and the kind of guy I'm looking for. I want to be certainly a friend first. So, you know, not looking for diving into anything deeply very fast. I really thought very carefully about it and put together what I thought was a, you know, pretty straightforward. This is who I am. This is what I like. And, this is who I'm looking for. I also did say that I had a child. I can't remember, to be honest. I did say I hadn't a child. So that was something to consider. But I sort of looked through the profiles. I met three different, guys. In the space of about 6 months. And the first one was a lovely guy, became a very good friend, a bit like a big brother. The second one was a bit like a mad axe murderer, and I kind of ran screaming from the first date, you know, trying to get away from him. And the third one was a social parasite who was really just after a new social life and wasn't really that interested in me. So I kind of just dropped it and gave up. And then a month or two later, I just got this email from somebody who I hadn't seen a profile of or anything else, but he just wrote to me and saying, long flowing letter about being American and mixed race and, you know, just all sorts of things. But he also said that he had mumps as a child. And so, if expanding my family was on the cards, then he was not the right guy because he was infertile and couldn't have children. I was quite impressed by how honest and open he was in that email.
Will Jordan is mixed race, with brown hair, brown eyes, and has an athletic build. He told Mary he was an American who was living in the UK, chasing his career around the globe, as he put it. He owned his own IT consulting firm and was attracted to Mary's independence as it mirrored his own. He was interested in pursuing a relationship further with her. And so they flirted and shared their mutual interests with each other.
We talked for about 2 weeks. I was a bit nervous about online dating. I've never done it before. I was, you know, didn't know how safe it was or anything else. And these are the days where you didn't have Google search. You didn't have all these things. You know, it was all the internet was really quite new in 2000. So it was all very, very new technology to me. So I didn't really think I should meet him too quickly. I needed to find out more about him. So we talked online for about 2 weeks, talking about the books we liked and the music we liked. And there was so much we had in common. It just sort of, we just seemed to click, really click on just on the internet. And then it was about 2 weeks later, we swapped phone numbers and he eventually called me. It's like, there in itself lies a tale. Yeah, he did call me and we talked for hours on the phone for a week or two. And we met, I think, in early December 2000 for the first time, having lunch in a public place, etc. When I met him, he was exactly as I thought he would be. He was tall, he was dark, he was handsome, he was not God's gift, but good looking, nice looking, just a really, really, seemed like a really, really nice person. Oh, my first impression, he was very charming, very humble, quite quiet, rather a good match for me because I'm quite a talker. You know, we both went to Pizza Hut, I think it was, and we both ordered pepperoni pizza. We just had so much in common. And it was just sparks were flying from the very beginning. I was very cautious and very sort of, I'm actually very happy with my life. I'm enjoying my life. You know, to take somebody into my life and have a boyfriend or have someone, especially around my daughter, was going to have to be somebody who's going to have to stand out and be really quite special because my life was pretty good already. So somebody would really have to improve it. And he seemed to fit the bill. He had this kind of calm, mature, solid, reliable attitude about him that I really liked. So yeah, that first date was quite memorable. And he kissed me at the end of the date, and I sort of didn't dive into it. I kind of pulled back a bit. But he was obviously very keen and immediately texted me afterwards saying his feet hadn't touched the ground since.
This was all too much for Mary. As she said, she wasn't really looking for love. She was successful, confident, happy, and she had a child that deserved her time and attention. But Will was just so great, so kind, and obviously falling deeply in love with her.
I was pretty confident already. Working as a business advisor for the Scottish Enterprise Network, which meant I went in and talked to CEOs, managing directors, and a professional busybody. I would go and I would tell them how they could run their businesses better. And this was paid for by the Scottish government. So I had quite a high-powered job, marketing consultant by trade, quite a confident person, quite settled, quite happy in my life. So when this chap came along, it was... It's hard to explain. He ticked all the right boxes. He came across as the kind of person who you just go, that's what I was looking for. That's the kind of person. But he was very, very keen, and it made me hesitate a bit. And I was quite resistant. He was the one that was constantly pushing the relationship forward. He was the one that said he loved me first. He was the one that, you know, he seemed to sort of have this urgency about him. That he just thought immediately he'd found his soulmate, and you know, told me that, and told me how you know this was it. He'd been waiting all his life for him to meet me, and the fact I already had a daughter as well, and he couldn't have any children was just magical, and that made all the difference as well. You know, that we already had a family, and it wouldn't be a problem for me not having any more.
Despite her hesitation, Mary was willing to take that leap and make everything official. The decision to move forward in a relationship with William Jordan would change her life forever.
I think we made it official very quickly that we were boyfriend and girlfriend, because that just seemed to fit. That was very clearly what he wanted. And, you know, I was happy to go along with that to see how things went. I did wait a few weeks before I introduced him to my daughter. And that was just before Christmas. I introduced him to my daughter, and then it wasn't, you know, leaving him alone with her or anything else. It was just to meet and before we went out on a date. But she liked him. He got on very well with her. He was very attentive to her. It was quite very, very serious, very quickly. And, you know, he would send me flowers, a dozen roses to the office. You know, so that all my office workers would see that someone was interested in me. He would send, you know, love notes. He would say, he would leave me messages. He would do all sorts of, you know, really sweet things, the sort of things you see in romance movies. It was all sort of terribly romantic and terribly, you know, sort of, it sort of swept you along. Even though it was sort of quicker than I would normally want to move, you know, he was very confident and his confidence sort of swept me along. It's odd looking back now. It's 17 years ago now for me, so it's kind of weird looking back.
Life with Will was on the fast track, and Mary knew owning his own firm would mean that he was often called away for business. She would sometimes get aggravated by the inconvenience of it all and try to understand that Will was a busy man. Then in December of 2000, after missing a rather important trip, he proposed to her. Mary said that she would have to think about it, but in the meantime, Will asked her to continue wearing the ring. Eventually, Mary would say yes. She, of course, had expressed hesitation upon first talking to him, but their romance was such a whirlwind. He seemed to expose himself emotionally to Mary, and she felt she could trust him. He even told her that the first time they made love showed him the two furthest extremes of emotion he had ever experienced, how much he had come to love her and wanted to be bound with her for life, and the abject frustration and despair of knowing he had finally found all that he wanted in a wife and mother of his children, but that the second part of the dream could never happen due to his infertility. Mary was happy to have found such a wonderful man who loved her deeply, but she began to grow suspicious of his disappearing act as their relationship entered the new year.
One of the biggest problems he had was his timekeeping, and that he was so dedicated and devoted to his work that he would drop everything for that. So if we were supposed to be meeting on a date and his work came up and said, we need you to do this, he would just drop it and run, and he would leave me standing. He would literally stand me up, which was a bit of contention and a bit of a problem. And it was the only thing that was wrong. Everything else, he was extremely attentive, extremely loving, very kind, very sweet, very gentle. But the only red flag was this disappearing act that he would do. About 6 months into our relationship, I actually don't know the dates, but a few months into the relationship, I started getting rather suspicious because of this disappearing act. And I actually found on Company's House an address that he hadn't told me about, and went and visited that address and found this house which had children's equipment in the garden and, you know, antenna on the roof and stuff. And I thought, he must be married and he's lied to me all along. So I called him and said, this is, you know, we need to talk. By this time we were engaged. He came back immediately and said, no, you don't understand. I need to explain to you. So he made me sit on the couch, and then he went out into the hallway, and he was on the phone for about an hour and a half. And here he was pacing up down the hall, and I could hear him talking. And my phone was beeping SIM update and MOD relay and ODCI relay. And I was going, what is going on? What is going on? And my anger sort of dissipated into total curiosity whilst I was sitting there, just going, what is the explanation he's going to come up with here? Because it just didn't seem to make any sense. And he came back and he sat down and he said, right, I'm going to explain something to you, but wait until the end before you just hold off asking any questions. Just let me talk. And he talked for about an hour or two and explained to me that he had been recruited straight out of college by the ODCI, the Official Department of Central Intelligence in America, being an American, that he was very, very good with computers, and it was his computer skills that the CIA wanted to use him for. So he wasn't a spy. He's one of the backroom boys that works with the intelligence community, helping them with their computers. And what he was doing was he was on secondment to the British intelligence, working on targeting paedophile rings, on using internet and IT technology to be able to do various things to help keep our community safe. And the house that I had seen was actually a safe house, and it was, that's why there was all the antenna on the roof. And of course he didn't have any children, he couldn't possibly have children, he couldn't father them, etc. So this is what he told me. And he said, you don't have to believe any of this, it's going to all be proved in time, all you have to do is just wait. So I thought, well, there you go. I've got an option to just wait and see, and I can reserve judgment. And he said all the proof would be coming in time. And it did, weirdly enough. It's all sorts of things that proved what he said was true, including he was paid via money packets from the Ministry of Defence in Britain. He was used to carry a gun. He had people who would phone me and verify that he was who he said he would, was. That there was times that he had to go away, that I would get phone calls now that I had been vetted and proved. They would phone me to say that he'd been called away. And, you know, so he couldn't, so no longer stood me up. And I got messages to say he wouldn't be coming. And I was kind of included into this, you know, wife of an intelligence officer scenario.
Now that Mary knew about his real job, Will began to advise her to be aware of her surroundings. If there were strange packages showing up or a person approaching her for information on him, this meant that they were likely trying to find him and kill him. Mary began to grow suspicious of those around her and who might try to get close to her just for information. He told her that it was best if she just keep everything about him to herself. Her family was growing concerned and suspicious of the man Mary was so deeply in love with. He finally met the majority of them in February 2001, where he asked Mary's father formally for her hand in marriage. Her father agreed, and his concerns were quelled for the moment when he finally was able to put a face to the name. Mary's knowledge of Will's work put her in grave danger. She felt like she was being followed and was always on high alert. Their life was going to be anything but normal. And at times, it kind of excited Mary.
Yeah, there was a normalcy to it. There was a suspension of disbelief as opposed to a completely buying into this all. It was all, you know, kind of waiting. There was going to be next week, next day, next something was going to happen. There was times when he was supposed to get loads of money for something like selling his house in America. And, you know, it just, there was, everything was just on hold. Everything was waited, you know, bated breath just to get the final piece of evidence, the final proof. And there was always, I suppose, part of me that kind of went, well, is this true or not? But I was just holding off, suspending that disbelief, just to see where it went. And the longer I left it, the longer I suspended that disbelief, the more sucked into this sort of brainwashing meltdown that was going on. And the longer it went on, the more sucked in I got.
Although still engaged to be married, Mary was in for a shocking surprise in July of 2001. She was pregnant. Instead of being happy over the miracle bestowed upon her now growing family, she was concerned about what Will would think. Would he tell her it wasn't his? Would he say she was unfaithful? He had been so adamant that he could not have children. It was impossible. She gathered herself and called him home. He returned back and turned pale after hearing the news. Mary's heart sank. Then he became elated at the news, saying, quote, "They always said it was a remote possibility. I just never thought it would actually happen." She was so relieved that he hadn't accused her of being unfaithful and that he was thrilled to become a first-time father. When she shared the news with her family, they were just as shocked but excited for the new baby. Mary's daughter was going to be a big sister. They were set to wed in July. Invitations had been sent and arrangements had been made. Then, Will disappeared. He would communicate with Mary through anonymous text messages simply labeled as Mod Relay. He said he was alive and well, but the wedding had to be canceled. Mary was embarrassed, but told her friends and family that it would happen, just at a later time. He would be gone from July 2001 until May 2002, saying he was in Israel and the West Bank, working to stay steps ahead of suicide bombers in the area. Mary was frightened for his life and often spent many sleepless nights with her computer by her bedside, hoping he would check in. He did, periodically, but the hours he could talk were when Mary should have been sleeping. She had one toddler and now was going to have a newborn demanding her attention. Their daughter was born in February of 2002. Will promised to be home soon, but That was always his response. This was his way of manipulating a sleep-deprived and worried Mary. She explains.
Looking back now, I can see a lot of the things that he was doing, the manipulation techniques he was using. There was one particular one that's called Black Ops Hypnosis, which at the time when I wrote the book, I actually researched and found out that you could actually learn this stuff online. Scary thought. But it's a manipulation technique where you ask somebody a question and then criticize the answer, even with just one word, by saying, really? And then, you know, you leave the person feeling emotionally ridiculed, but then you immediately build them up again. So if you, for instance, if you say, what's your favorite movie? You might say The Shawshank Redemption, and they'd say, really? And they go, oh, well, I suppose, yeah, it's a very popular movie. Yeah, I can understand why you like that. So you feel like you've just looked like a complete idiot, but that they've forgiven you for it and actually been really nice and built you back up again. But actually what they're doing is minute by minute actually knocking you down. And if you can manipulate somebody's emotions, you can actually manipulate them and brainwash them through regular use of various techniques. And that was just one of them. So looking back, I realized that, you know, I spent all the time thinking that he was actually building me up and being kind to me and being very loving. But actually what he was doing is constantly knocking me down and constantly sort of manipulating my emotions and leaving me in a state of sleep deprivation, leaving me, because he always was able to, the only time he was ever able to talk to me when he was away was in the middle of the night. So I would have my computer on with the volume turned up so that if he came on Messenger, I would hear the ding of his first message and I would get up out of bed, even though I had a 1-year-old daughter. So I was already sleep deprived. You know, I would constantly be getting up in the middle of the night to just be able to talk to him. And it just became more and more sucked into this kind of mindset where the only person I could trust was him. The only person I, you know, would look after me was him. And he became my absolute world. And having been this strong, confident, independent, sassy woman, I became this rather sad, you know, lonely girl who couldn't tell anyone what was going on. I couldn't talk to anyone. If I told anyone what's happening, I was putting them in danger. The further it got in, the more scary it got, and the more disturbing it got. Because, you know, shortly after we got engaged, I found out I was pregnant, which he said was an absolute miracle, that he was told that he one in a million chance he could actually have a child. So this was a miracle baby. And, we had our daughter in 2002. And now we got married in 2002 as well. He was called away to the Israeli-Palestinian territories. So he was actually away for the birth and only met his daughter when she was 3 months old. So then again, I was sleep deprived for having a small baby. And, you know, it just, things just got worse and worse, but just gradually. And it was constantly promised day by day that things were going to get better. Everything was just about to resolve itself. Everything day by day was just about to get better. That was the torture. That was the absolute torture. The fact that it was constant, this constant hope. It wasn't despair that actually destroys you. It's hope. So it's like, but hope that things are actually going to get better. And the promise that they're always just about to.
I asked Mary how Will was as a father. Since he was gone most of the time, what was home life like when he was home?
Yeah, as a dad, he was absolutely fantastic. He was just loving and kind and gentle, attentive, funny, and would play games with them and just be absolutely brilliant. And as a husband, he was just as attentive and just as loving. And I mean, even when he was away, he was writing me letters and emails and texts and stuff and sending me photographs of what he was doing in his office and where he was and, you know, other work colleagues that he was, you know, talking to and what they thought of the situation, how much he missed me and et cetera. He just very attentive, very, very attentive.
He returned from the Palestinian territories in May of 2002, war-torn and haggard. Life with Will Jordan was only going to grow more complicated.
When he came back from the Palestinian territories, his feet were in a heck of a mess. They were mangled and, you know, split and bruised. He'd he'd said that he'd been in the Jenin massacre, which was, he was sort of trapped behind enemy lines for about 3 months. And so he was supposed to be there for 24 hours, but he'd been there for 3 months and he hadn't been able to take his boots or socks off for that amount of time. So by the time he actually got back to safety, they had to actually surgically remove his socks. And, you know, he was in a terrible state and he wanted out of the intelligence services then. He just wanted to get out of it. So our daughter was only about 3 or 4 months old, but he wanted to, and when he came back, he was thin and haggard and really not looking well at all. So first things first, he wanted to get a job. So he actually went and got a job with a, shall we say, very large software manufacturing company. Very well known one that was paying him about £10,000 a month to work with them on their IT and design new software for them. So he was doing very well and earning a lot of money for a while. And he was really enjoying the work. He was enjoying just being a civilian. And things were going quite well until somebody he worked with, he was wrecked. Recognized by somebody who he'd done a undercover operation with, and he sent me a long explanation as to what had actually happened. But he had basically been identified, and now that he was, you know, had a wife and child at home, wife and children at home, they had threatened to kidnap the kids and rip bits off them and send them through the post if we didn't come up with some money. So we were basically being blackmailed by people who are the kind of people who would fly planes into the Twin Towers. Without any kind of compulsion, they would rip bits off a child to get money. So, it was quite terrifying. It's quite a terrifying time. I was living in fear the whole time of people coming into the house and stealing the kids. He was away most of the time. And he issued me with a taser, which is thoroughly illegal in Scotland. Any kind of firearms is illegal in Scotland. But I was issued with this taser so I'd be able to defend myself. It's very confusing because it's such a complicated story. This is why I had to write a book about it, because it's so complicated. It took 60,000 words just to explain what happened. So I was living in fear. I mean, I became pregnant again. So had our son in 2005, and by which time I had run out of money. I'd sold my flat, I'd sold my house insurance, I'd sold my life insurance, I'd sold my piano, I'd sold everything to raise money to try and keep the kids safe. And it was still the money drain went on. Still, he kept contacting me saying, you know, there's more money needed. These people are going to do horrible things to us. There wasn't anything left. Eventually, I just had to say, it's gone. I have nothing left. I'd borrowed money off my family. I'd done everything I could, and I literally had nothing left.
It was now 2004, and Mary had been living this life of uncertainties for over 3 years. One day, while Will was out on assignment, Mary found his brown leather satchel. It was something that he always had with him, generally, no matter what. But this time, he left it at home. He had his important papers and gun in there. She was bit by the curiosity bug and opened the bag. She found a marriage certificate and passports for 2 small children. She was concerned and confused. She knew that Will lied for a living, but he was always transparent with her. She phoned him to return home immediately so they could speak. When he arrived, she told him what she had discovered, and after making a phone call to his superiors, he said that he could finally tell her everything. He said the woman was an asset and was his cover, and that it was all a con. She was needed to protect his cover and to protect the family he had with Mary. He managed to convince Mary that everything he had told her was the truth. Their second child, a son, was born in 2005, and Will was absolutely enamored by his second miracle. He missed the birth again, but this pattern of behavior came to be expected. Mary had moved in with her parents since she lacked support both emotionally and financially from the person she was expecting it from, her husband. Things took a turn in November 2005.
I got a phone call. I got a phone call initially from the police saying, "Where's your car?" And I said, "My husband's driving it down in England." And they said, "Thank you," and hung up. And then I got a phone call from Will saying, you don't know what you've done. You don't know what you've done. This is terrible. And it turns out that actually he had a, Will Jordan had a fiance who he'd been using her credit card illegally. And the police, she'd set up a police sting to catch him when he used the credit card to pay for the repairs in the car. And when they found the car, they found papers pertaining to his original wife in the car. They found that I owned the car, and I just described this as being driven by my husband, so they knew he was a bigamist. They found the taser that he'd issued me in the car, so he was charged with carrying a firearm. And it also turns out that he's also a convicted paedophile, so they charged him with also with not registering his address under the Sex Offenders Act. So he was arrested, and it all came out. All the story came out. It turned out he had two wives and five fiancés. That he wasn't marrying women because he loved them. He was actively impregnating women to rip them off for money, me being one of them. And my children, my two lovely children by him, have 13 brothers and sisters by six different women that I have found so far. And that will be the tip of the iceberg. That will be the tip of the iceberg. There will be far more. And that's spread across America and the UK.
You heard her right. William Jordan was a bigamist. Not only was Mary his second wife, but he had children and women across the world. Mary describes what happens next.
The weirdest thing is that everybody expects that when I get the phone call from another wife saying that she's married to my husband, has been for 16 years, she has five children to him, she knows the nanny has two children, etc. This bizarre thing that it would be a shattering phone call. But in a very, very strange way, my life had been so horrendous for so long. And to turn out and realize that actually it was all just this one man, this terror that I'd been living in of my children being kidnapped and murdered, was actually not real. So in a lot of ways, getting that phone call was like getting a get out of jail free card. It was a relief. It was a release to know that actually it was just him. There wasn't this conspiracy going on. There weren't people and unsavories and horrible people out to get me. It was just him. So weirdly enough, actually getting the phone call was a relief. And it was bizarre. I mean, it was a very physical reaction when I got the phone call from the other wife saying that this was real, this was her, and all the information she gave me. I felt very physical. I mean, it was like my blood ran hot around my body and I was shaking. And, you know, it was the only way I can describe it. It was like coming out of the Matrix. It was like the walls of reality just crumbled around me and I could see everything very clearly for the first time. And it was like all of the brainwashing, all the controls that he'd put on me over the 6 years I was with him just crumbled away. And I suddenly could see very clearly who he was, what he'd done. But it was a release because I knew absolutely that day that it was all him. There was nobody else after me.
The surprises kept coming for Mary, and on April 5th, 2005, she received a phone call that convinced her the life she had and knew with Will Jordan was a complete lie. I will not be sharing the name of the woman Mary speaks with at the request of both women.
As soon as she phoned up and she was like, I want to see you, say face to face, we need to talk. So she immediately said, I'm driving up to see you. So she was coming up from Oxford, I think it was. So it was about a 4 hour drive. So about 4 hours later, she turned up on my doorstep and I didn't want to invite her into my home to start with because I felt a bit weird about it. So we went off to a cafe, and when we were in the cafe, you know, just having met my husband's other wife, we were standing there at the chap who was serving it, and he's looking at us rather blankly, and we're looking at each other and looking at him, not really knowing what's going on. And he said, "No, can I help you?" And I said, "I don't know. We both found out we're just married to the same man." And he looked rather taken aback and said, and I said, two cups of tea. And he said, "Do you want to share a pot?" Completely. I don't know why it was so funny. It was just absolutely hysterical. But we sat for hours. We sat for about 6 hours and we talked, and she showed me photographs of her children who look exactly like my children. I mean, they're like the Midwich cuckoos. They're so similar. All the children. You, when you see one, you just go, yep, that's one of his kids. that's one of them, because they all look the same. They've got this, I don't know what it is, but look about them, but they all look the same. Even though they've got different mums. But yeah, it was a weird day. It was a very weird day. She showed me photographs. She showed me birth certificates. She showed me, marriage certificates. She had a whole lot of information with her. She thought that I wouldn't believe her. But the thing was, as soon as I heard her on the phone, as soon as she said to me, you know, "Are you Mary Turner Thompson?" And I said, "Yes." And she said, "Are you also Mrs. Jordan?" And I said, "Yes." And I thought it was his lawyer phoning. And she said, "I'm the other Mrs. Jordan." And then she said, "Have you been told I'm an agent?" And I said, "Yes." And she said, "I've been told you're an agent." And it was that, you know, it was those eight words really that actually shattered the world that I've been living in. Because, you know, when I had found out about her existence, you know, a while back, he had convinced me that she was actually just a name, just an agent, somebody who was there to allow him to stay in the country, not actually a wife. So yeah, but it's such a complicated story. This is why it's so difficult to actually explain. Just so much detail involved, and so much. I don't know how he did it. I don't know how he managed to keep all the details and all the plots and the subplots and the everything going on in his head. It's so complicated. It's such a feat what he could have done if he'd actually tried to do something good.
William Allen Jordan would eventually be charged with bigamy, dishonesty offenses, failing to register as a sex offender, and illegally possessing a stun gun. In total, he had married one woman in 1992, Mary in 2002, and had several relationships with other women, including the nanny of his children. The sex offender charge came as a result of him being previously convicted in 1997 for 3 indecent assaults on a girl under the age of 13. He did this to drive a wedge between the young woman and her mother. They were getting too close to each other. For the aforementioned offenses, he was sentenced to 5 years in prison. Mary had the daunting task of informing her children of their father's misdeeds.
I mean, the two most devastating things I had to do was to tell my mother and tell my children. I had to tell my mother quite quickly because we found out very quickly afterwards as well that she was terminally ill. And I needed to tell my mother to cut me out the will because Will Jordan had not only taken, you know, hundreds of thousands of pounds from me, but he'd also left me £56,000 in debt with credit cards that he'd taken under my name and used as his spouse cards. So I had to tell my mother to cut me out of the will for that reason. And also then to tell my children as well. And I did think long and hard about what I should tell the children. And I thought, well, I could tell them that he's left me or he's died or something. I could tell them a lie. But one day they're going to find out the truth. One day it's going to come out and they're going to know that their mother lied to them. I could just not tell them anything, and then they're going to grow up being confused and upset by the fact that, you know, I didn't tell them anything. And I realized pretty quickly that the only thing I could do was just be honest. Telling the kids, told them was by saying, if your father was blind, you wouldn't blame you. But your father has no emotion. He has no empathy and no remorse. He is devoid of conscience and remorse. I've never said in my life, I've never said what a swine or any other rude word that you might say about someone. I've never said that, never to the children, because that would never be helpful to them to be angry or bitter or twisted about it. I've always been very rational, very logical with it, and just said, look, this is what's happened. This is what it, you know, he's done. We found out that he has these other children. I didn't initially tell them about the paedophile conviction. I didn't think that was something they needed to know. They do now know, but they didn't then. Bearing in mind, my children were 7, 4, and 1 at the time this happened. So my 4-year-old used to sit on my lap and cry and say, where's daddy? And every day I would sit with her on my lap and I'd cry with her. And then there came a day where she didn't sit on my lap and cry. And she went off and played. And then the next day she did. And then there was 2 or 3 days that she didn't, and et cetera, et cetera. And it just, we recovered together. And we cried together and we talked together. And we found out, we understood together what was going on and why he'd done what he'd done. But we worked through it together, and we worked through it without anger, without bitterness. And I think that's so important to do, because I think I see so many couples that you know, tell the children what's going on, but tell them angrily. And that's no good for the children. That's no good for their self-esteem. Because if you decry one parent, you're actually decrying half of the child's genes. So you're saying, you know, that's who they are. But if you say that their behavior is not okay, then that's not trying the child's genes.
I would love to say that his story was over, but it isn't. He only served 30 months in jail and was deported back to the United States, where he was free to begin his con again.
I have to tell you that as a sex offender in the UK, he should be on Megan's list in the US. And he's not. Because the New Jersey State Police do not want to, or can't be bothered, or have not tried to request the records from the UK. And we have tried this end. We have tried contacting them since he was deported back to the USA in 2009. We have tried many, many times to get the New Jersey State Police to actually request the records. Initially, they said that he wasn't actually liable to be on Megan's Law list because he was convicted in the UK, which was not, you know, in the US. But actually, the law changed in 2008 and hadn't filtered down to New Jersey yet, that actually anyone who was convicted in Canada and Britain and Australia and had convictions for the sexual offences was actually to be on Megan's Law list as well if they were living in the US. He will never stop. He will never, ever, ever stop. Not until he draws his last breath. Because he is a psychopath. He's not a bit of a bad lad. He's not just a con man. He's somebody who enjoys manipulating people. He enjoys this game. And he, for the most part, gets away with it. You know, he runs 3 or 4 or 5, 6, 7 relationships at a time. And he rips them all off for money. And that's his career. That's what he does. He impregnates women and rips them off for money. And anything, the means to which he does that is, you know, he's very creative. He could quite easily find a millionaireess, even a young, attractive millionaireess. He is good enough at what he does to be able to marry a millionaireess and settle down and have a lovely, quiet, comfortable life. He would not, because if he's a psychopath, he would be unbelievably bored. So in 2009, he was deported back to the USA, and very quickly I was contacted by first lady who was pregnant and alone and homeless, and then 3 more very quickly after that. And then everything went silent for about 3 years. There was nothing. And I knew he'd changed his name at that point. I knew that he'd sort of found a way to stop people finding out who he was. And then in 2014, I got contacted by this lovely lady, also called Michelle, but a new fiance, who was also pregnant and who he'd ripped off for about $5,000. And she had been told that he was British intelligence. We helped set her up with hidden cameras, and she set him up with police sting, and he was convicted of fraud. He was charged initially with sexual assault by deception, which those charges were dropped. But she is now fighting to get sexual assault by deception to be incorporated into law in the US. And she's an amazing woman. She's absolutely phenomenal. And she's now my US counterpart. She now helps victims out there and keeps tabs on him. He lives now in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. I think he's going by the name William Allen. He has on his white pages, I think it is, he says that he's an executive officer. So I don't know what that means. But we kind of keep tabs on where he is and what he's doing if we can. We do know that he was cited a couple of weeks ago buying little girls' clothes. So we suspect he already has a new young family with a stepdaughter. And we just hope that she finds out in time, the mother finds out in time before things go too far.
I asked Mary why she wanted to tell her story. What warnings could she offer the listeners about psychopaths, her book, and where is she now in her life?
One of the reasons I wanted to share the story is that I, first of all, feel like I have to do everything I possibly can to help protect future victims of William Allen Jordan. I need to know that when people come forward and say, I've just found out that this man has fathered two more children with me, and has ruined other people's lives, bankrupted them, etc., that I can say honestly with my hand on the heart, I have done everything I possibly can to inform the world so that they know what's out there. Secondly, you know, I'm such an advocate that people should never, ever have to be embarrassed or ashamed about having been a victim of a crime. I know I'm not stupid. I know I'm not particularly gullible. I was a bit naive. But people blame themselves and blame other victims of being conned. And if I can help by standing up and saying, here's me, intelligent woman, I got conned. If that helps other people, then that's worth doing. One of the things I find is when I, this is going to sound like a roundabout way, but it's hopefully it'll make sense. When I first wrote the book, people asked me whether I was going to write it on my own name, that I should somehow be embarrassed by what had happened. And there is this perception of idiocy if you have been conned. And the truth is that it's not the idiots that get conned. It's the people who don't think it will happen to them. It's the people who feel confident and intelligent and wise. And often, actually, it's the ones who would say, oh, I'd never get caught by that, who actually would. So the ones I always feel sorry for, the people that look at my story and say, oh, she must have been desperate. She must have been needy. She must have been, you know, so desperate for a relationship. She accepted anything, because those are the people that are actually most at risk because they don't think they can get caught. And if you want to keep yourself safe from psychopaths, learn about psychopaths, learn and understand how they do what they do. And most important is actually accept that they exist. Accept that there are people out there, 1% of society, 1 in 100, who have no conscience, no remorse, no empathic response to other people's pain, and they can do anything they want. To them, life is a Sims game, and we are all Sims characters which are just there for them to play with and manipulate. And if you don't think that's real, if you think that everybody has a conscience and everybody has some sort of form of emotion, then you are at risk, because that's what I was. I thought everybody was basically nice, everybody was basically decent, and that everybody basically had a conscience. And it didn't cross my mind that people like him actually existed. I'm not saying that everybody you meet will be, but if you are aware that 1%, 1 in 100 people are capable of doing absolutely anything, then when things start going a little bit wrong, it rings a bell. If you think that everybody has conscience and everybody has, you know, is kind and basically a nice person, but maybe a bit damaged, then when the warning signs come, you brush them off and you ignore them. So I'm not saying that everybody you meet you should be wary of. I'm just saying, you know, it's like the thing saying, you know, not everybody online is a psychopath, but every psychopath is online. So just be aware. I thought I was keeping myself safe by talking to somebody for 2 weeks and making sure that I knew everything about them. But of course, what I was doing is giving him two weeks to research me and find out everything about me. So when he met me, he was the perfect guy. You know, if you are online dating, then use it like meeting someone in a bar. You don't tell them everything about yourself. Find out about them first. Ask them to volunteer information rather than allowing them just to agree with what you like. You know, et cetera, et cetera. It's just awareness is the most important thing. It's being aware that these people are out there. And what's so terrifying is that all the research I've done over the last 10 years, and I'm now a bit of an expert on psychopaths, is that they make up 1% of society. 1 in 100 people are psychopaths. 1 in 100 people have no conscience, no remorse, no empathy, no actual emotional attachment, even to their own children. That they don't care. They have no care. They are cats playing with mice. And we are the mice. They're the predators and we're the prey. And it's as simple as that to them. And anybody who they say, anyone that they think has emotion, they think is just an idiot and has been, you know, has been brainwashed by society to believe that there are such things as emotions, and we deserve everything we get because of it. About 2 weeks after I had the conversation with my husband's other wife, found out my mother, who I was so close to, was terminally ill with cancer. She only had a few months to live, and she'd said to me she was relieved that we had found out, you know, before she died, that she knew I was on the road to recovery. And one of the things she said to me is she would have always been an author if she could have. She was an amazing writer, amazing, amazing woman. She said, "You've got to write this down. You have to." She said, "This is just, you need to, for yourself and for other people, you need to write this down." I'd walked into a bookshop and I'd said, "You know, look, this happened to me and I want to read a book about it. You know, what books have you got about bigamy?" And the man looked at me blankly and shook his head and said, "None. There aren't any." And I thought this was absolutely extraordinary. So I walked into a publisher and I said, "This has happened to me and I'm going to write a book about it." And they grabbed me with both hands and said, "We'll have that, yes." They commissioned me to write it, because up until that point, there had been no books written by a bigamist wife about bigamy. There'd been a couple of sexy romps about how sexy it is to have two wives. But there wasn't actually any books written from that perspective of the victim of a psychopath. So it was kind of a standalone book. It doesn't really have a genre. It's true crime, but it's a true crime psychopath thriller. Weird one. But it was my journey really started. I went to the Edinburgh Book Festival and did a couple of workshops. Luckily, I also met a lovely lady there called Jenny Brown, who's my agent now. Turns out she's actually one of the best agents, so I was very lucky to get her. But she was absolutely awesome as well. She's been amazing, amazing help. Thoroughly recommend anybody who gets into writing or becomes an author to have an agent, because they're really good. She was awesome as well, and she took me on. And initially she said, "You might need a ghostwriter." And I sent her a few chapters, and then she said, "One thing I can tell you is you don't need a ghostwriter." And I thought that was very kind of her. So, I mean, I'm not the best writer in the world. All I've done is tell the story as it happened from my heart. And it seems to be very well received, which is rather nice. I'm in such a good place. It's not true. I spend a little bit of time every day on Twitter with, you know, looking at the people who are just recovering from psychopaths or narcissists. Or sociopaths, and trying to respond to them saying, you know, this is the beginning of your journey and, you know, it's all going to get better. And, you know, sort of trying to help and support people who are at the beginning of that journey, because it is terrifying when it's like coming out of the matrix. When you find out your whole life has been a lie and this person who you thought loved you the most is actually manipulating you all along. So having somebody on the other side of it 10 years on saying it gets better, and it gets better really fast, and, you know, you do, life is good, you know, and it just, I do try really hard to sort of be there for other people who are going through something similar. Yeah, one of the marvelous, marvelous things about writing the book is I get letters from people about twice a week who have read the book, from Australia to America to Denmark to, I mean, it's in Czechoslovakian, Swedish, Dutch, Polish, all sorts of wonderful languages. And people write to me saying, you know, "You've just saved my sister. You know, she was in a relationship and we've just realized what was actually going on because we didn't understand." Somebody who wrote to me saying, "I was on the point of committing suicide, and then I actually read your book and I realize now what was happening and what's going on." People who have said, something similar happened to me 16 years ago and I've never been able to talk to anyone about it because I felt utterly ashamed. And I think that's awful. I think it's a terrible, terrible thing that people who have been victimized in this way actually feel embarrassed about having been a victim of a crime. And I think that's shocking that we sort of glamorize these con men and these fraudsters to the point and ridicule the victims. I think that's terrible. And that's something I really want to change. As for where I am, I'm in an absolutely fantastic place. I have three wonderful children who are, you know, my best friends, so I get to live with. They're 18, 15 and 12 now. And we're really, really close. My kids are pre-disastered. So they're all their friends come and say, "Oh, I've got boyfriend trouble." And my kids go, we've lived through worse.
I want to thank Mary for taking the time to tell her story. It was an absolute honor to speak with you, and I appreciate your advocacy to warn people about William Allen Jordan. Listeners, remember, this man is on the loose in the United States, possibly on the East Coast in New Jersey. He's a predator who should not be permitted to ruin the lives of innocent women and children. I hope that the state of New Jersey finally requires him to participate in Megan's Law and forces him to register as a sex offender he is. You can find Mary's book titled The Bigamist on Amazon. She is also on Twitter at The Bigamist Book or on her website, maryturnerthompson.com. All links will be available through the show notes. Mary has generously offered a signed copy of the book to one lucky listener. You can email the show, tcfcpod@gmail.com, to submit your name, shipping info, and what you would like your special message to say. Okay, fan club members, as I conclude this episode, my one question to you is, how will you sleep tonight? Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to subscribe, rate, and review on Apple Podcasts. It really helps us out. You can find us on most social media platforms, Twitter at TCFCPod, Facebook.com/TCFCPodcast, Instagram TCFC_podcast, and of course, our website is TrueCrimeFanClub.com. Thank you to Ben, the amazing host of the podcast They Walk Among Us, for voicing Judge Thomas Corey in the beginning of the episode. I would like to welcome to the club our most recent Patreon supporters, Emma C. and Karen S. Our music for the show was provided by We Talk of Dreams, who created custom music just for us. Check them out on Twitter at We Talk of Dreams or WeTalkOfDreams.com. Content editing for this episode was provided by Brittany Martinez. To discuss this episode, please be sure to join the Facebook discussion group where we can discuss the cases more in depth. Just search for True Crime Fan Club Discussion Group and one of our lovely mods will add you. While you're waiting for the next episode, check out some of my pod friends' shows.
Hey, true crime fans, have you listened to Wine and Crime yet?
We're a true crime comedy podcast hosted by three childhood friends who chug wine, chat true crime, and unleash our worst Minnesotan accents.
Each week, us gals pick a true crime topic and pair it with a delicious wine before delving into the background and psychology behind the crime.
Then we share and speculate wildly about a couple of bonkers cases related to the topic.
Past episodes include necrophilia, cults, crimes of passion, cruise ship disappearances, exorcisms gone wrong, all this over a bottle of wine, or, let's be real, three.
Listen anywhere you get your podcasts. You can also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Wine and Crime Pod, and check out our website and blog at wineandcrimepodcast.com.
Cheers!
Hey, Linda.
Hey, Louise.
What's wrong?
Well, I love podcasts, but I need a new one. Do you know if there are anywhere two sweetie sisters talk about movies from the 80s and 90s that shaped their childhood existence, and also that have a cat that makes a ruckus in the background?
Do I? Let me tell you a podcast I started listening to called Large Marge Sent Us. Two sisters break down classic 80s and 90s movies like The Princess Bride, Neverending Story, and Pee-wee's Big Adventure. They even did a whole month dedicated to Fred Savage flicks.
Wow, I love Fred Savage. Where can I get this magical podcast?
You can subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, YouTube, or Google Play. You can also follow them on Twitter at The Sweetie Club. And don't forget to tell them Large Marge sent you to this podcast.
Hi, I'm Kim.
And I'm Felicia.
And we're from the Harry Potter Revisited podcast.
Each episode is based on the next chapter in the series.
We make inappropriate jokes and crass comments along the way.
Check out Harry Potter Revisited on iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app.
Bye, Felicia.
I'm the mother.
I'm the daughter. And we're the Crime Girls.
Hi, y'all. If you like your true crime with a touch of banter or vice versa and a southern accent, you should join us at Crime Girls Podcast.
We discuss lesser known true crime cases, crime news, and our dogs.
You can find us on iTunes, SoundCloud, Google Play, and Stitcher. Thank you.
Bye.
Hi, I'm Lainey, host of the new podcast, We're All Just Pretending. It's a podcast that has elements of Dear Abby with a twist of Post Secret. Every episode, I'll read listener questions and provide advice and insight as a friend. My own pod friends will even join in and offer their advice on parenting, relationships, and even give you really bad advice on purpose. Since we all have secrets to share, there'll also be a segment focusing on letting the skeletons out of your closet. If you're looking for advice or want to share a secret, head to allpretendingpod.com. And remember, we're all just pretending here.